The passage that we're going to start with this morning is a passage that we all are, I think, pretty familiar with. The thing that... Why it's so much louder? I guess it's because of that. The thing that struck me, though, this morning is, why is it here? In the middle of a section, he ended the second chapter with being righteous as he is righteous. And then he's going to pick up in the third chapter and verse 4, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness. And so what is it about this verse that would put it here? Behold the manner of love which God bestowed upon us in calling us the children of God. So what does that have to do with righteousness and evil with in the context here? Anybody want to? And there's no right answer. And you won't find an answer in your book because I never thought about this before until today. So
that's where the Holy Spirit wanted it. That's the answer.
Okay. Well, that's right. That's a very simple, good answer. But if you look in verse 3, it says everyone who has this hope in him does what?
Purifies
himself. So that's why it's there. It's there as a motivation in the middle, really almost right in the middle of the book. It is there as a motivation to all of us. The privilege, the honor, the greatness of the gift that God has given to us should motivate us to do the same for him. And so, remember, we started the book with this concept of Gnosticism, which essentially is saying that the scriptures are not enough, that God didn't give us enough information, that we can add to that information. And yet, here we have, did God love us enough to make us his children? Yes. Does that mean he's given us all the information we need to be his children?
Yes.
Sure. And so, that's really what this passage is about. But it does give us an opportunity to reflect on some very important things. Now, in the Greek language, and you can't really pick it up in the English, but in the Greek language, the word behold is a command. It's in the imperative mode, which means this is a command, and it essentially means look, behold, observe, consider what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us or on us. And so what John is commanding here is that each one of us take some time to consider this. And so the question you might ask yourself is, have you ever done this? Have you ever just sat down? You can't do it here, but sit down and consider and observe and ponder all of the things that the love of God has brought to us. Carl?
Pay attention.
Yeah, well, pay attention. Yeah. Keep this in the forefront of your mind. It's kind of like Peter says, beware, or be sober. Your adversary like the devil. So beware, be sober, observe. These are all different words, but they have the basic same idea. And that is, can you go through life asleep?
No.
Can you go through life distracted?
No.
Jesus said, the cares of this world, the desires for other things can do what?
Choke
the word and we become unfruitful or fruitless. And so we have to be engaged at all times. And if we're not, we're in the middle of a great battle, and if we're not in it, what's going to happen? We're going to get destroyed. So behold or observe or keep this in the forefront of your mind. God has given you a great blessing, a great privilege, a great honor. What are you going to do with it? Did I see him, Carl?
It's like driving a car.
Yeah, like driving a car. And I think I have a sermon on that. Is Christianity like driving a car or sitting in your easy chair watching TV at night? And, I know that's what it is, but I'm asking you, how do you perceive your Christian life? Some people live their life and Christianity is an afterthought. Some people, Christianity is their life and the rest of their life is an afterthought. And it's a very important question to ask ourselves that. How did Jesus come to this earth? Was it an afterthought or was it his whole life? And what was his expectation of the apostles? And what were the apostles' expectation of the brethren? And so anyway, this is the motivation or the dynamo or the energy that we need to keep doing this. And if we've never really thought about it, this is the time to do it. And so there's a lot of things that we could think about in the what manner. The word manner here is kind of an interesting term, as I point out in toward the middle of the page, where it says, and you see the underlined sections there, what manner of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? Now, is that just a casual comment, or are they really impressed? What kind of guy, what kind of man can do this? And then when they look at the temple, what kind of stones are here? And when the Pharisees looked at Jesus and that prostitute, that wicked woman is touching him, and what manner of woman is this? And so these are concepts that we really have to delve into. What manner of love did the Lord bestow upon us? What does Paul say about that in Romans chapter 5? While we were still enemies, while we were still sinners, God manifested his own love for us. And then he says, who would you die for? Would you die for just a man? Anybody here going to die for somebody? And I hope some of us would say yes, because, you know, I talked to the people in Malawi about this, about their wives. I said, if they fell into the river, would you save them? And they started laughing. They just thought that was ridiculous. None of them would do that. And how many of you here would die for your wives? Don't raise your hand. Just think about it. I don't want to embarrass anybody. How many of you would die for your children? How many of you would die for... and so it's a selfless thing, but it manifests what? If you would sacrifice your life, what is that showing?
Your great love.
Okay. Didn't Jesus say that? Greater love has no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you keep my commandments. So, and that's where we're headed here. So, you can expand this out. Does John 3:16 manifest the love of God? Does Mark 16:15 and 16 manifest the love of God? Well, yes. All of these things, forgiveness, mercy. Does getting out of hell manifest the love of God? Often, we'll ask people, if all you could get from serving God was just not to have to go to hell, would it be worth it? But then God gives you even more than that. But I would definitely serve God just to not have to endure that for eternity. Did I see a hand up here? Oh, Carl?
When you think about the power of God, that he has the power to have anything he wants, you wonder, why he want to bother with us?
Well, that's... You remember, I don't know which psalmist it was, but he says, I'm a worm and no man. And isn't that about how badly we've marred our image? He made us a little lower than the angels, and now look at us. It's just a sad situation. We're just a shadow, just a shell of what God wanted us to be.
I don't think we have the capacity to comprehend God's purpose.
Well, no, not fully. But that's what makes it fun. You get all this information, and then you try to consider it. You try to figure it out. All right, so behold what manner of love. Now, this is a general concept. He's focusing more on something specific. He says, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God. Now, this begins a new section. We're going to see in verse 8. He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. And then verse 9, he who is born of God does not continue to sin, for his seed remains in him. And then verse 10, in this the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. So those are our options. Now before we become a Christian, what are we? Children of the devil, right? We're children of, how did Paul put it in Ephesians chapter 2:2? You were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. But God, being rich in mercy, even when we were dead, made us alive together with Christ. And by grace you have been saved through faith. It is a gift of God. And it's a gift of God, not because we don't have a responsibility in it, but because compared to what we have to do, which is believe and be baptized, compared to what God had to do in sending his Son to die for our sins, is it a gift of God? Did we earn it? Does belief and being baptized earn it? No. But does it have to be done in order to receive it? Yeah, it's a conditional covenant. But regardless of that, it's still a gift of God. I mean, comparatively speaking. So, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, now we are the children of God. So, we have been called. Now, remember the Greek word call is kind of an interesting term. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 10, we are called through the gospel. When we become called out, what are we? Ecclesia. Called out. The church. So the church is the called out. Who does the calling? Well, God does. Does Jesus also call? Come unto me, all you who labor are heavy laden, and I will give you rest, and you will find rest for your soul. So God calls, Jesus calls. Remember Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, behold your calling, brethren, not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called. Why? Why does Paul say that that's the case? What did God choose? Foolish, base, and he put him in the call. So he only wants a humble, submissive, and agonizingly desiring. If you want it bad enough, does it matter what God asks you to do? Kind of like, you remember Naaman, the leper? Did he want it bad enough?
Not
when he got mad. You look at it and you say, how bad did you want this? And that's what his servant said. If he asked you to do something hard, wouldn't you do it? What are you thinking here? Why would you go home without doing this? So the word call, again, we are called out. We are the church, and we are called to be children of God. Now, there's a couple of verses here I want to look at. I think they're on page 59. Yeah, at the very top of the page, what did God give us the right to do?
Become children of God.
Okay, and who did he give that right to? As many as? The first part of the verse, but as many as what?
Received
him, he gave the right. So we have to receive Jesus. Even John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth, and of course the world takes belief in a very superficial way. As James points out, is faith just belief?
No.
Chapter 2?
No.
Faith without works is dead. So the more works you have, the more
faith
you have. So Hebrews 11, isn't that what Hebrews 11 teaches? By faith, what did Abel do? Did something a lot better than Cain did. And by faith, Noah did something better than the rest of the world did. And by faith, Abraham, same thing. And all the way through, they did their work. By faith, each one of those individuals did what God asked them to do. Some of them were easier than others. I think maybe Noah's job, you think that was pretty tough to build an ark? How about Moses' job? By faith, Moses, when he forsook Egypt, do you think? Yeah, I just can't imagine. Can you imagine going to the promised land and then all of a sudden, I mean, through no fault of your own, God says, all right, 40 years in this wilderness. And for Joshua, for Caleb, and for Moses, was that fair? No. But that's the life he had to live in order to fulfill the purpose of God. Brian?
Yeah, and the beauty of faith is that it's reinforcing. You know, in some cases, they immediately saw the effects of their faith when they did what God asked them to do. In some cases, they didn't see anything but the hope that was out in the future. But a lot of those men and women saw God's providence come to fruition, and it reinforced their faith.
Right.
And it can for us as well.
Yeah. No, I got a phone call this week from someone who wanted to place membership here. And he said, what are your criteria? And I said, first thing, you have to attend all the services. Now, is that fair? I mean, how many churches are requiring that now? And could you go across town to Smoky Hill? Would they tell you that? Probably not. Many congregations, they just glad you're placing membership. They don't even ask you for anything. And so, but is that a fair thing to ask of people?
Yes.
Well, of course it is.
Yes.
What if everyone in this church just missed when they chose? Sometimes they came Sunday morning, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they came Sunday night, sometimes they didn't. What kind of a church would we have?
What kind of faith do they have?
Well, yeah, no, I'm not asking that. If everybody had the level of faith you did, would the church here be better or worse?
Worse.
It would?
Well, I'll put it in
Oh, Laura, we need to talk.
I was on, like, if you were saying that people kept missing and stuff and weren't coming to every service, I was still on that train of thought.
Yeah, okay, and I moved on.
Okay.
So we're going to let you answer that again. If everyone in the church had your faith and your works, would this church be a better place or a worse place with your, what you're contributing? And what are we asking for? We're asking for people to build up the church. If they're not willing to do that, why would they want to be a member here? And so, again, this is just a simple, straightforward situation. If you want to be truly believing, I mean, did Jesus think the church was important enough to die for it? How important should we think it is then? Seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things will be taken care of. But most people put the other things first. Carl?
I must say that we have a pretty good attendance record here.
Well, yeah. That's because we basically cull out. I mean, if you don't want it, a lot of people, when they hear you got to come to all the services, what do?
They move on.
But you have to scratch or shake your head, because if they won't even do that, then what else are they going to be doing? Are they going to be talking to their neighbors about the Lord? Are they going to be praying without ceasing? Probably not. Jeff?
Well, and certainly there are a lot of spiritual implications of what we're talking about. But even at a simple level, in terms of just the logistics, I mean, most members are relatively familiar with, you come in, you visit, and you sit down. Services are held, and then you get up and visit me late. But if you stop to think, what happens if, for some reason, the preacher doesn't show up, or the song leader doesn't show up, or two or three people that are, slated to lead prayer, or whatever, don't show up. Even when only one doesn't show up, there's a little bit of a, I won't say scrambling, but, you have to make accommodation. If that was the norm, it would be chaos.
Yeah, no just organization. I mean, if that was your attitude toward work, what would your boss say?
You wouldn't last long.
Matter of fact, it's even funny, because if I were to call today and say, look, this is a perfect day to paint my house, so I can't make it, what would people be saying? He should be fired, right? What kind of a preacher would make a decision like that? But isn't that a double standard, if you might do the same thing? And it's not that a preacher is employed by the congregation per se. He is serving the Lord, and what's the congregation doing?
They're supporting
him in that work. I've always been a little shy of thinking that a congregation has the authority over the preacher. What should he do with preaching then? If the congregation has authority, what should he only preach? What the congregation wants to hear. And I'm not saying that the preacher doesn't have responsibility to the congregation and submit to them, but I'm saying that should the choice ever come where it's God or the congregation, what's the choice everyone would expect now? That we would follow God. Carl?
Yeah, well, when you told a person regularity in assembly, that's a command. That wasn't your idea, it was God's command. He commands us not to forsake the assembly.
Sure. And that's why we ask for that. Some people say that's an arbitrary criteria to expect people to come to every service. Is it?
No,
it's not arbitrary. It's a command, like Carl said. All right, Charles.
Yes, a lot of people, and I've gotten into this discussion with people before. They feel like if the church is 9 to 5, I'm sorry, heaven is 9 to 5.
Oh.
You ain't by 9 and you're out by 5.
Right.
And if you have that type of attitude here, well, then some kind of way it feels like, if I do go to heaven, I'm not going to judge that. But it's not going to be like that. You either where you are permanently or you're not there.
Right.
And we know that when this life is over with for us, we're going to be one of two places. So it's preparing us to go to the place where we will permanently be.
Right.
So we have to have that type of attitude as we grow and as we learn. And that's hard sometimes for people to accept.
Yeah, that's right. But is there any above and beyond in the church? In other words, I'm going to go beyond what the Lord wants me to do. What did Jesus say about that? If you've done everything it was commanded you to do, you should still say,
unprofitable
just
servant.
An unprofitable servant. We've only done what you were told to do. You can't go beyond that. All right. We're kind of going a far field here, but I always feel, and you probably notice this about me, I like to make applications. When the scriptures are giving us a wonderful reward, what should we do? What's our side of this? So, what's that?
Oh, to receive it. I thought you were asking. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no. Well, no, that's fine. That's fine. All right. So, behold, verse 1, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God. Therefore, the world does not know or recognize us. And this is a crucial point because even to this day, I did an article yesterday on the denominations, and so I was looking at where each one came from, and guess where we are? We're not even in there. They don't recognize the Church of Christ for a couple reasons. Now, they put Disciples of Christ in there because in the Christian church in there, and then down at the very bottom in a couple of them, they'll have Church of Christ. But for the most part, and as Jesus pointed out in Matthew chapter 7, the way that leads to life, how many are on that road? Just a few. And so the world isn't going to know God's people because in the world's eyes, they're insignificant. And even beyond that, not only are they insignificant, but are they a little bit of a problem to the people in the world? Remember John chapter 3, they don't come to the light because their works are evil. And so the world doesn't know us. And so these Gnostics, do they recognize the value of these children of God?
No.
No, they look down on them. And that's the way it's going to be. Even in the Beatitudes, the last Beatitude, blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. In other words, that's going to be the norm, and you're going to have to deal with that. So the world doesn't know us. And it still doesn't know us. Even in a time where there is very little persecution, we are still mocked and scorned. Our expectations of what people are going to do come from the scriptures, whereas everybody else comes from their own mind. Carl?
It seems that percentage-wise, the Lord started with 12, and he's going to wind up with 12.
Well, I hope at least I'll be there, so that'll be 13.
Considering all the people that has lived and gone and so forth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at the generation of Noah. How many? And then the generation of Moses. How many? I mean, how many thousand left the Promised Land?
Men, about 200, or 600,000.
Okay. And how many got in?
Two.
Joshua, Caleb, and Joshua and Caleb. Now, that doesn't mean that all the people that died in the wilderness didn't get to go to heaven. Did Moses die in the wilderness? Is he going to be in heaven? So there's going to be a few, but again, it just goes along like that. There's always a remnant. In the days of Jeremiah, how many could Jeremiah find?
None.
Virgil?
Yeah, sometimes just the language like this, the few and the many, becomes confusing. What was the promise that was given to Abraham? That he'd be the father of men like the stars in the heavens? To us, that's many, 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 many. But to God, how many is that in comparison to how we look at things like that?
Right. Yeah. No, that's right.
I thought there was only about 2,000 visible stars.
Yeah, but that's why that statement is so sublime, because at the time it didn't sound true. But when you get the telescope, what do you find out?
Oh, there's a lot more.
Yeah, there's an infinite number, and that can God, does God have to go by what Abraham can see? No, and if Abraham asked him about it, God would say, "Hey, there's a whole lot more than you think." Rob,
I agree. Over time, there's going to be few. The scriptures teach that. But we can flip that around, too, and be encouraged by the few, even today, that are trying to do the right thing. Because if you think in negative terms all the time, it can become very depressing. But I'm glad people here at Holly Street. Even during Jesus' time, yes, there is few. But take great hope. Look at those in Hebrews that did do. So we can gather that there's still those trying. There's still those putting forth the effort to try to be one of the few. And that, I don't know, I have to do that anymore. It becomes so depressing to think just how many few there is, but I also flip it around and say, you know what, but there's still people trying to do what's right.
Right. Well, it's just realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that when we tell people what God expects, then there's just a few who are interested in doing what God expects. And the depressing part is when we let that get to us. It's not our fault. We're not the ones who crafted the gospel and designed the gospel. God is. And if we're going to preach the truth, if we wouldn't preach the truth, could we be big? Look at these mega churches today. Are they big?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why? Because they don't preach what God wants them to preach. That's why. And so when somebody says to you, how big are you? And you say, well, we're pretty small. I mean, if you come visit our service, we don't have instruments and we don't. And is our singing really wonderful here? I guess that's relative, isn't it?
In man's eyes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But compared to what? It would be the question. From God's perspective, us doing it the way he commanded, is that pretty special? Yeah. Charles?
Yeah, also now, Revelations do talk about the fact, and I'm not sure if this is what it's talking about, it does talk about a number that no man could number. And as John was writing this, there's no telling how far in the future that he was looking into the future.
Right.
But it do talk about a number that no man could number. You know, are we in that number? Am I in that number? Are you in that number? But see, we don't know because he's looking a lot further than what we could even think of.
Well, and that's true. I mean, when you've got how long is this going to go on?
Yeah, that's the thing.
See, if it goes on another 20, 30, 40,000 years, you think we'll have a number beyond counting? And we may already. Sure. I mean, because we're talking about from the beginning, how many billions of people have been on the earth? And so percentages are small, but over time, more and more people are being added. And I don't know how many thousands and tens of thousands of Christians have gone through America since the 1700s. I mean, there's been a lot of people. But compared to everybody else, it's still a small number. All right, well, anyway, I wanted to get at least through verse 3, so let's pick up here a little bit. The world does not know us because it did not know him. And Gnosticism and denominationalism continue that trend. And they don't know the people of God. They can't even recognize the people of God because they don't know him. Anyone who thinks that Jesus is going to tolerate the kind of religious division that we have in the world today, do they know him at all? So they don't have a clue. They didn't kill him because he told everybody, do whatever you want. All right, so verse 2, beloved, now we are the children of God. And it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. So now we're arguing from the great to the greater. In verse 1, the glory of being called the children of God is tremendous. But even though it's tremendous, when we know what we shall be, in other words, what we're going to be after this life is over and at the resurrection, is that going to be a whole lot greater than just being called the children of God? And I say just being called, that's not really the way I wanted to word it, because he words this as a tremendous honor. It's a tremendous honor just to live in this life and be a son of God, and a daughter of God, a child of God. But we are the children of God, and that's a great honor. But what's coming, it has not yet been revealed. Now, does Paul get us kind of close? In 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about the third, fourth, and fifth days of creation. He talks about the bodies of terrestrial body, the celestial bodies, the sun, the moon, and the stars, the bodies of the fish, the bodies of the birds, the bodies of the animals, the bodies of man. But so does God know how to make bodies? Yeah, he knows how to make bodies. Does that help us to understand what we're going to be? Nope. Nope. Because what do we know about spiritual? We don't know. We're going to have five hands. We're going to have five fingers in heaven. We're going to have 2 feet in heaven. Anybody know?
Are you going to have hands and feet?
Yeah, we need. Do we even need that? Are we going to have a stomach in heaven? We're going to have a mouth. Well, we'll probably have a mouth, right? Can't sing without a mouth. But anyway, we don't know what we're going to be. But when he is revealed, now, who is the he?
Christ.
When is he going to be revealed? At the second coming. When he is revealed, we will be like him. In other words, our pattern will be the pattern of the divine body that he possessed throughout all eternity. So we will have a body like his body. We will be like him. And so I've got to be preaching a little bit on that this morning, so we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that right now. But let's just go to Philippians. Oh, no, I don't think we have to do that. Let me turn here. I think if we turn the page to... No, maybe I will have to go over there. I can't find it. Philippians 3, verse 20. Yeah, let's just go over there. I can't find it here. If I can't find it, you probably can't find it either. In Philippians 3, verse 20, it says, "Our citizenship is in heaven, from which we eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body that it may be conformed to his glorious body, according to the working by which he is able even to subdue all things to himself." Now, you could probably misunderstand John when it says we will be like him because we will see him as he is. But when it says he will transform our lowly body to be conformed to his glorious body, is there any way to misunderstand that? No. I have a lowly body now. He has a glorious body. When I see him, I'll look up at him. When I look back down at me, what do I have?
Same.
I have the same body as he does. And with what kind of powers will we have? We had dominion before we sinned. Are we going to have dominion again? Yeah, we're going to have total dominion. Anything we want, anything we can visualize, we're going to be able to do. There won't be any hindrances. Nothing is crooked. That which is crooked cannot be numbered or cannot be made straight. That which is lacking, there won't be anything lacking. There won't be anything that's crooked. So we're going to receive a glorious body. Now, that's a living hope that Peter described in 1 Peter chapter 3, or chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. So, is anything God asks us to do too much? With that kind of reward set waiting for us? And that's John's point. If you have this hope, what are you going to do? Everyone who has this hope, verse 3, purifies himself just as he is pure. Now, is it a lot of work and painful to purify ourselves? Most people just don't do it. They minimize their sins. They just, I'm just human. I'm not going to worry about it too much. There's no agony. There's no sense of worthlessness that should come as we're trying to purify ourselves. Am I being too harsh? Is that not correct?
Pharisee and the publican.
Okay, Pharisee and the publican. What about, I dwell on high with him who is brokenhearted, contrite in spirit, trembling at my word. The attitude that God wants to see as we are purifying ourselves is one of great zeal and great disgust as we go through the process. You remember that song, "Oh, the bitter pain and sorrow that a time would ever be? When I proudly said to Jesus, all of self and none of thee." And the process goes. And Jesus says, what kind of an instrument do you need in order to accomplish this? If a man does not deny himself and take up his cross daily. Now, that beautiful cross that's a golden emblem that people wear around their neck. Is that what it is? No, it's an instrument of death. It is a terrible instrument of death. And that's what we need. This growing as a Christian, hang on a second, Carl. This growing as a Christian is a painful process. But if we have this hope, are we going to minimize it or maximize it? See, we're going to maximize this. We're going to grow to hate sin and hate ourselves when we continue to fall into sin. And the further we go, the more disgusted we're going to be, because the more we can appreciate what we're giving up and what we are doing when we're involved in these things. Carl?
One thing we have to guard against in this country is our affluence, because we're rich in this country compared to other countries. We've got washing machines, we've got cars, we own homes, and we're a very affluent society. And we have to keep reminding ourselves where this comes from.
Yeah, no, that's right. This should draw us closer to God. But Jesus makes the warning that the more you have, what does he say about the rich man? Is it kind of tough for a rich man to get into heaven? Like a camel going through eye of a needle. Is that pretty tough to do? So Jesus says that's how hard it is for a rich man to get into heaven. Now, when the apostles say, well, who then can be saved? What does Jesus say?
God, all things are possible.
Yeah, with man it'd be impossible, but with God, all things are possible. So God can, he's got ways to make this work. Carl?
I did some study on that once, and it's not a sewing needle. It was a hole in the wall of the city.
Right.
A small hole in the wall of the city. The camel and the man had to get on their knees to get through that hole. That needle, the hole in the wall of the city. And that's what Christ was talking about. A rich man is not going to get on his knees to go through that small space.
I'll have to look at that, Carl. I never heard that before. Not that I'm doubting you, but I'll take a look at that.
Yeah.
All right. What's that?
It's controversial.
Is it? Okay.
Some commentators have said that.
Okay.
So.
And it very well could be true. All right. So now, if you notice in your book, I have about 20 pages on what we shall be. And I put this in the book because if you're really going to be able to fulfill this commandment that he says, behold what manner of love the Father has given us to become children of God, because enfolded in that is we are not yet clear on what the children of God will be manifested to be. And so the more we understand about that, the more we're going to purify ourselves, the more we are going to understand how glorious we are. So we start with life after death, and we move to the resurrection, and we move to the second coming, and then we move to the judgment day, and then finally we start looking at what God has described about heaven. So you can look at this or not. I'm not going to go through these things. I may, as I said, I'm about to start our series. I took a look, and it's been 4 years since we've talked about these things, so I usually like to do it every 3 years, so we're going to go back over this series on what we are going to receive after this life is over, and the steps that just keep getting better and better and better. All right, so let's go ahead and jump ahead then to page 77, which is where we just got to. And now let's see. What I wanted to talk about was, okay, and there's Philippians 3. We're just looking a little too soon. But then we will see him as he is. This is an interesting concept. Is Jesus in the same body that he had with God in the beginning, or is he in a body now that we're going to receive at the resurrection? Virgil?
Good question. I think so. It'll be a body that we can recognize, because as he ascended in heaven, they seen him as he left.
Right.
He was in the body then, but the only way that we can take and figure it out in order for him to do what he did had to be in still a spiritual body. But it was something that we can see, people seen.
Right.
That is the way it's going to be.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking this question is because in 1 Timothy, where it says that God desires all men to be saved, what does he identify the mediator as? Man or God? Himself, man. And thinking to yourself, wait a minute, is he man now? Well, he will always remember the experience of being a man. Now, whether the body that he's in reflects that or not, and I'm just trying to be careful here, because if we say he's in his divine body and we're going to be like him, what would that mean? We will have a body of God, which I'm not real clear that that is something we are looking for or looking forward to. I don't think that'll be the case. Although God may have made all the angels made in his image and likeness, not just a spiritual image and likeness, but also in the spiritual body they have. Virgil?
Another aspect of that is the bodily resurrection that we read about in the Corinthian letter. How is that going to play out in this? There's something that could be seen. Spirit has not flesh and blood. We know that's
right.
It. So, but I don't know at the end of this thing exactly how that is going to play out. We right. know right now that we cannot see God. We cannot see Jesus. But in the end of time, there's going to be some recognition that takes place.
Right. Yeah, I've got to at least have the same nose so you know who I am, right? Mm-hmm. We'll get to have it. I don't know how that's going to work. Maybe we'll have something on our forehead. Oh, that's Alan. Oh, that's Moses over there. I mean, how are you going to recognize Moses when you get up there?
That's a good question. Really?
Yeah, it is a good question. And what's that?
We don't know that we will.
We don't know that we will recognize each other? Well, did Jesus recognize Moses and Elijah when they came back after thousands of years or a thousand years? So Peter and John knew who they were. I don't know how they knew who they were. Maybe.
We know in Hades that recognition is there.
Right. Yeah. Did they recognize Abraham?
Yeah.
How about Lazarus? Yeah. There's Lazarus over there. Now, again, that's probably a parable, and there may not be. But here's a good question. When Saul called up Samuel, did he know who he was?
Yeah.
Now, is that because God changed something? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The point is, do we keep our personality? Do we remain the same person after we die? Yeah, we're still the same person. We still have the same name. Now, again, whether that'll go into the eternity, I don't know that I want Alan in eternity. I might want a better name than Alan. And some of you who don't like your name, maybe you want to change that name. You want to be a goose law in heaven, Virgil? All right, Carl. I'm just being facetious. But,
one thing.
Carl?
We're not perfect now, but we do know that he said that just man will be made perfect.
Yes. Well, and that's right. And we're right in the middle of Deuteronomy 29:29 here, aren't we? The secret things belong to God. All I know is that it's going to be very far better. It's going to be amazing. And that's the point, is let's look forward to these amazing events and not grumble and complain about the sacrifices or the difficulties that we have to go through in this life. Because, as Paul said in Romans 8:18, I reckon that the sufferings of this present world are not worthy to be compared with what?
Things that are revealed to us.
The glory that shall be revealed in us. So, it's going to, by far, compensate. And again, remember the context here. What are the Gnostics trying to tell us? They got something better. Can you get better than that? Can't get any better than that. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there, and we'll pick up on page 80, verse 4, starting next week. And do some work on that. I want to talk about that a little bit next week. Those who truly know God, they don't sin. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean about us? Because if we say we have no sin... So let's work on that. We've got to work that one out. There's not a contradiction there, but there is a paradox there.